Hey, welcome to the podcast. Nice to have you on board. If this is your first time checking it out, welcome. And if you've been checking it out, thanks for coming back. Before I get to my guest, do me a favor. If I'm holding the door for you, just say thank you, okay? And look up at me. At least acknowledge that I'm there. Get your face out of your phone and texting. And just as you're walking through the door, just even just a little nod or something. Give me the finger, all right? Call me an asshole. I don't care. Because right now, when you do that to me, I basically feel like your manservant. You might as well just turn to me and go, hey, go make me some eggs while you're at it, okay? So just acknowledge me. Otherwise, I will cry. I will just fall into a fetal position and cry in a public place. And nobody wants that. My guest, world's best jazz trumpeter, Keon Harrell. I heard about this guy. He's got an amazing new CD out. He has played with Jay-Z, Beyonce, Rihanna, Lauryn Hill, the cream of the crop. And he also is the trumpet that you're hearing on the Miles Davis biopic starring Don Cheadle. So if you see that movie or you've seen that movie, that's him playing. Really cool guy, really cool backstory. And I did this because I wanted to learn more about, you know, music and the specifics of jazz and jazz trumpeting. And you're going to really find it interesting. Enjoy it. Thank you for checking this podcast out and continuing to support it. The best way to support it is to tell your friends about it and also to leave us some comments on iTunes if you don't mind. But really spread the word. I'm really proud of the different guests that we've had and continue to get that kind of cross all spectrums. I hope you're enjoying it as much as I'm having fun doing it. So thanks. Check out Keon, and we'll see you next week. Hey, folks. Thanks for checking in on the podcast. And really cool guest today, super talented musician. Keon Harrell is joining me as a new album.
What's up?
How you doing, brother? Everything good?
Everything's good.
All right. New album out called The Mugician. Just came out. And you are one of the, as they say, world-renowned trumpeters in the world. Toured and recorded with Maxwell, Beyonce, Jay-Z, Rihanna, man, Common, you keep some good company. And really cool that you supplied all the trumpet playing for Don Cheadle's Miles Davis biopic. So all the playing that you see Miles doing, you're hearing your work, and really, really cool to have you on. Thanks for being on the show.
Such a pleasure to talk to you, man.
Yeah. I was really fascinated by how you describe this album and what you're trying to do. And one of the things that you said was that you're telling a story of how I felt I lost everything and how this project was a reminder that I lost nothing, because what I felt I lost, I had not been created yet in terms of music. And that really kind of blew me away. Explain what you meant by that.
You know, I was going through a lot. You know, I had gone through a divorce. I had gone through, you know, pretty much I thought I was in, you know, the worst place that a person could possibly be. Mm-hmm. And I was basically picking up the pieces, and I was in New York one day, parked on Fifth Avenue. And, you know, the second worst thing could have happened, you know, 10 years of my intellectual property was stolen. I had a record that I was almost done with. All of my hard drives, all of my studio equipment, everything was stolen out of the car. So at that point, you know, it was, you know, a realization that either I could, you know, sit here and cry, you know, and, you know, fall off the earth, or I could, you know, move forward. And at that point, you know, things started opening up to me in a major way. I really started to believe again. I started to trust that, you know, when you lose certain things, you know, it really is the beginning of you growing, the beginning of you taking that next step to go further. So, obviously, you know, I did the record, The Mugician, and, you know, most of that music wasn't created. There was only two songs that actually survived that I had, you know, somehow managed to save. I had did some work in Danny Masterson's studio, mm-hmm. Bronson Island, mm-hmm. in L.A., which was so random. First of all, to do that session, and it was so random that those were the only two tracks that survived.
Wow.
Stay This Way and Wayfaring Traveler, mm-hmm. From the record are survivors. Everything else is brand new.
Mm-hmm. And how, I mean, I'm a stand-up So, you know, a creative type, I guess, like yourself. And when I'm having some downtime and not, I don't mean hanging out, I mean like not feeling good about things or where I am or whatever, I kind of find it difficult to kind of get my creativity going, you know? And so how, when you have something like that happen to you, you're going through a divorce, you have your property stolen, where are you true to the emotional state that you're in? And are you sort of writing and playing sort of out of that? I don't want, maybe it's depressed. You tell me if that's the right label, but like,
it was a depressive state.
You should be, you wouldn't be a normal human being if you weren't depressed after that shit, man. That's tough. That's tough stuff, man.
Exactly. That's the real shit in life that you go through that defines you.
But that's what you have to write about. And that's what you have to talk about as a comedian and as an artist. You have to talk about the real stuff. Otherwise, why are you doing this, right?
Exactly. You got to paint the times. You got to paint what you're going through so somebody else can, you know, get something out of it.
Right.
So, you know, from that, and typically when I'm going through shit, you know, that's when I am my most creative. Right. Honestly, weirdly enough, that's the time that I'm, you know, the most visceral experience, the real stuff that you can get. For me, I probably just, you know, something probably just happened to me, or I'm going through something. And I really, really like to put that on, you know, put that on some kind of canvas. I really like to record that. I really like to talk about that. So, you know, me going through that stuff definitely propelled me to another place, honestly.
Yeah. I mean, you talked about that this album took you to a deep place. You had to question your initial intentions for the album artistically. Do I want to simply play the trumpet and simply show that skill, you say, or do I dig deep and make a meaningful statement socially as well? And, you know, you're from Ferguson, Missouri, and obviously the terrible thing that happened with Michael Brown. And did that, I know that was years earlier, but did that layer into any of this? And what, I mean, obviously you were trying to make a statement personally from the place you were coming from, given what you just described, but socially, what were you trying to say with this?
Socially, from the album, I wrote a song called MB Lament. MB obviously stands for Mike Brown. You know, so I wrote this song for him. I was in New York City when it happened. But me being from Ferguson, me being, you know, an African-American kid growing up, you know, I looked like everybody else. Well, not everybody, a lot of the people in Ferguson. And I thought to myself, you know what, that could easily be me. That could be my son. That could be one of my nephews or my cousins or my brothers or anybody, my friends. I've been arrested, you know, 3 times, never been charged. So I know what it's like to, you know, to be looked at differently, you know, by law enforcement, and they not know exactly who I am. So it's the kind of thing to, you know, I had to write about that experience. MB Lament is of that. I mean, it's not to, you know, to dog the police or anything like that, but it is to lament the idea that it happens so often. And it's most of the time it's not really remedied. It actually is getting worse. So, you know, I wrote that song MB Lament, and I actually, you know, changed the title to When Will It Stop, because, you know, it was you know, Lindo Castile and Earl Garner.
Right.
And, you know, so many other people that was just getting killed for no good reason at all. So I renamed the song to MB Lament. Then I named it back to Mike Brown Lament, and I wrote another song that features Guy Tori, which is also a companion to MB Lament, called When Will It Stop? You know, but socially, it's very important that I talk about that stuff, because everybody doesn't have that story. So most people don't believe this is actually a reality.
Right.
I tell people a lot that me coming from Ferguson, when I moved to New York City, I looked at a lot of police officers, you know, in a certain way. I thought they were going to stop me. I thought they were going to do this. When I moved to Pennsylvania to the picket fence area, you know, I would get stopped by the police, and it would be the most pleasant experience that I've ever had.
I thought you were going to say the opposite.
Where I lived, you know, it was literally, you know, the burbs.
Yeah.
And I never had a problem. They, you know, they basically wanted to take me out to dinner pretty much. so it was a totally, you know, a tale of two cities as far as, you know, the way you're looked at.
Yeah.
honestly. So, and I didn't even know that that could exist anywhere, being from Ferguson. So now I know that. Yeah. And that's what really put the flashlight on, you know, the way I grew up. It was very different.
Yeah.
And the fact that it's still the same way, we have a long way to go.
Yeah. Well, and then you see Charlottesville and, like, you know,
exactly.
As a black person, or if you're Jewish, particularly, like, I think mankind is inherently optimistic and wants to see the glasses half full, especially given what African-Americans go through, what you just described. But then you probably maybe start to get hope that it'll get better. And then you see that. And do you mm-hmm. feel yourself writing something about that at some point, or do you feel like we're making progress or in that area, or do you feel like it's sort of staying about where it was with Michael Brown and we haven't gotten any better?
You know what it is? It's more of an exposure thing. It's people, you know, noticing that it actually exists.
Yeah.
Like I said, I didn't really understand the idea of the systemic racism in Ferguson until I left. Mm-hmm. People don't really know that the problem with, you know, this neo-Nazi movement and everything, you know, it really has always been here, but it's now being exposed because of Charlottesville.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's the kind of thing, it's not going anywhere. It's just people are more aware of it, mm-hmm. which could help eradicate it. I hope it eradicates it. But, you know, it is a process. And the fact that the more we know, the more we can combat mm-hmm. it, I think.
Yeah.
And I definitely will take pen to that. I definitely will be writing something about that in the near future.
Yeah.
Definitely been stewing over it.
It's a great pleasure and honor to be able to be creative and be able to make commentary about things that are important to you and society through your art. Right. I mean, I can mm-hmm. imagine that's. I would imagine, like, everybody who starts in their art, like, it's like, for me, it's like, oh, this is going to be fun. I'll tell jokes and people laugh. And for you, it's like, I want to play music. I love the sound of it. I want to show people how I can play. But then I think you kind of grow from that, right? And then you start to mm-hmm. see that there's more you can do with this gift that you have.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It is that thing to where you realize your purpose. You know, it obviously starts off as some kid, you know, falling in love with an instrument.
Yeah.
You know, learning how to play that thing, and then, you know, getting focused, and then all of a sudden you can play somebody else's music. Then it comes to, what is your statement? What is your purpose? What do you have to say?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not my job to make jokes. It's my job to, you know, highlight, you know, what's really going on in the streets in my way.
Mm.
So I finally, you know, taking that on as an artist.
Yeah. Well, you talk about growing up, you have nine kids in your family of musicians, your grandfather, who was
No, 17.
Oh, I thought they were. Oh, oh man, I shortchanged you.
It's nine boys.
Oh, got it. Okay, 17. How do you have to make an appointment to see your mother and father when you're one of 17? How do you do that?
You know what was funny, and right now is great. I want to thank my mom and dad for just being fantastic growing up. You know,
shit. Yeah, you got to thank them. That's 17 kids.
They're incredible. I was with them yesterday yesterday.
Oh, that's good.
But you know, my family is such a close knit bunch that yeah. you know, anytime I come home, it's a family reunion. Anytime somebody says, you know what, it's my birthday, it's like nobody has to send out invitations, anything. It's just mm-hmm. all of a sudden is, you know, like 30 people in front of your house. So you know, it really is a thing. We have a good time.
Yeah. Man. And your your grandfather was a police officer and founded the Memorial Lancers Drum and Bugle Corps, is that right?
Yeah, he was a police officer, and he wanted to do something that was, you know, that would help kids.
Yeah.
So he started off with his grandkids and the kids in the neighborhood in a little town called Kinlock, Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
You know, teaching kids how to play the drums and play horns and stuff like that, and learning discipline. It was something to keep kids motivated,
yeah,
and give them a true focus, a true art, give them a way to see past, you know, where they were. And it's helped thousands and thousands of kids.
Yeah, that's great. And in your family, who were the musicians in your family? How did you start to get hooked on music, not just to listen to, but maybe want to play it and mm-hmm. all of that?
Man, I always looked up to my elder siblings, my So Steve was almost like a prodigy. But when he was 7 years old, he was like, you know, an incredible trumpet player. He didn't move on professionally, but he, I always looked up to him. But I mean, he's a professional musician now. I mean, he's a keyboard player and he's a pastor in church. But my brother Emmanuel Harold plays drums with Gregory Porter. He's a fantastic musician, producer, writer. My brother Jason Harold is another fantastic producer, music producer, works with 50 Cent and a lot of different people. Who else? My brother Al is a bass player and a wrestling coach. And
well, Jesus, why don't you guys save money? You're all related. Just form your own band, Jesus, and live in your parents' house.
I'm saying we try to play together as much as we can.
That's unbelievable.
As a matter of fact, there's at least 11 of my siblings on the album in some capacity.
Is that right? That's amazing.
Yeah,
that's really cool. And did your parents themselves have musical interest or taste or ability, or is just it started with one kid and it kind of caught fire with the others?
It really is a family affair. My mom is a singer. My dad sang and played horns, and you know, they're both were pastors, so music was always in the house. Music was always around, and you know, the backdrop of everyday life.
When I was a kid, I used to beg my parents to stay up. You know, I didn't sit there and say, I was going to go grow up to be a comedian, but I couldn't wait to see a comedian on the Tonight Show. And I would beg my parents to stay up late. And then I'd go to school and I'd like recite the guy's or woman's jokes and I'd get laughs from my friends and stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where this spark was for me. Obviously you're surrounded by family members who are musically inclined. But were you sort of connecting with other, you know, musicians? I know you said your influences are Miles Davis, Aretha Franklin, the Beatles, Jimi Hendrix, Quincy Jones. It's really a wide swath of people. Like, at what age did you start to connect with a certain kind of music outside of what your family was doing?
Man, interesting enough, the way you described, you know, you reciting the jokes back to the television, to the Tonight Show.
Yeah.
I would, you know, I had learned the skills to play the horn.
Yeah.
But I started listening to like Duke Ellington, who's a trumpet player named Cat Anderson. Mm-hmm. He used to play so high. Maynard Ferguson. I used to listen to those people and I would try to play the way they play. Mm-hmm. And like you say, you get those laughs. I would go and people would be like, wow, how did you do that? And I would only be, you know, transcribing what they did.
Right.
And trying to be like them and emulate them.
Right.
So that was a part of my development. Mm-hmm. I started playing with, you know, as many people as I could in St. Louis at that time. There's a guy named Jeremy Clements, mm-hmm. who's in New York, an amazing drummer. We grew up together. We had a band called the Young Jazz Messengers. Mm-hmm. And we'd play a lot. I'd play, you know, I'd try to go anywhere. I end up going to this camp in Colorado where I met Terrace Martin, Robert Glasper, Brandon Owens, all at the same time when we were in high school, we were playing together. So that, you know, just that, group of people, you know, was motivating and, you know, inspiring. We were sharing, we were, you know, giving to each other and pushing each other to the next level.
And
so, from the age of 11, 12, mm-hmm. you know,
and you talk about guys like, Maynard Ferguson, Miles Davis, let's throw Wynton Marsalis in there.
Absolutely.
Talk to me about, I'm going to geek out on you here because I'm not musically inclined, but I am I am so fascinated about how you guys can hear these sounds, then you put these sounds together and then you put words to them and then there's a chorus and then there's a thing and like I can barely write a sentence in my head. Describe to me if you can as just a layperson, like a Maynard Ferguson and what he brings to the instrument versus a Miles Davis versus a Wynton Marsalis and what makes them all great in their own way.
Mm-hmm. So I guess this is the anthology of the trumpet.
Okay, hang on.
Somebody
I'm going to clear out a couple of hours. I'm ready to go. No, I'm just kidding.
Right. So we'll be here for a while.
Yeah, no. I hope you don't mind. I know it's a big question, but I just...
It's a great question, and I've never, you know, put it together in those terms. The idea of somebody like Maynard Ferguson, who had the agility to play all over the trumpet, his range was, you know, pretty much unmatched. Mm-hmm. He could play as high as you can go. He can play as loud as you can play. He had the facility and vocabulary to, you know, to do a session with Clark Terry and Clifford Brown. Mm-hmm. If you can imagine how different each one of those styles were, mm-hmm. they were on the same track. So mm-hmm. his ability, you know, was incredible.
Mm-hmm. And you're not talking about physical ability, but you're talking about his ability to sort of understand.
Exactly. To make music, to be in the same musical plane as one of the greatest trumpet mm-hmm. players and lyrical players in music, Clifford Brown, mm-hmm. who is, you know, who's my favorite trumpet player. But Maynard Ferguson was there too, playing his style, which was equally incredible. Mm-hmm. So Maynard, Clark Terry, so Freddie Hubbard is another one whose style, you know, was just special, which I think created what the contemporary trumpet player builds from. Hmm. And I'm really happy I had the opportunity to meet Freddie Hubbard, and I told him that his, you know, trumpet playing literally was the makeup of what the contemporary trumpet player plays.
So if you don't mind, what did he do? What was the bridge that he created into this contemporary sound, and how did he do that?
It had a lot to do with his technical ability, his mm-hmm. technical ability to play whatever it is he was thinking, mm-hmm. mixed with the harmonic information that he had picked up, his theoretical knowledge of, you know, what could be done, what could be manipulated with this instrument, mm-hmm. His approach to music, which is his individual style, mm-hmm. You know, his heart came through the horn.
He might play a particular note differently or than you would or Miles or Maynard, right? It'll be this.
Exactly.
If I say this note and I'm going to hear it, but I'm going to hear it with its own, your own thing, Keon's thing versus Miles' thing, right?
Exactly. You know, his thing might be more warm. His thing might be less vibrato. Miles may play with no vibrato. Mm-hmm. Maynard Ferguson may play with as much vibrato as you can take.
Right.
But at the same time, you can really hear that honesty. You can hear that pain. You can hear their struggle. You can also hear their, you know, their gratitude or whatever it is that they're feeling at the time.
And then this is also we're talking jazz on top of this. So it's not just that somebody like a Maynard could play with anybody and in all types within the genre, but then, and technically all of these people, including yourself, brilliant. Okay. But then it's another thing, maybe it's vocabulary is the term, I'm not sure, but then that person's ability to improvise is different. Every mm-hmm. person's different, right? So you're going to improvise differently than Wynton's going to.
It's how you put those words together.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's the same thing with a comedian. Like I like to talk to the crowd, and I'll go up and I'll talk to some people for a little bit and then do my material or whatever, mix it in. And then another guy who might like to talk to the crowd come up after me, and there's the same people there, but he'll talk to them differently or hit on something differently. So maybe that's sort of a parallel in a way, you know, like kind of you got the same material in front of you, but you're doing different things with it.
Absolutely. And it is the way people talk. You know, Miles was all about space.
What does that mean? Like, in other words, just taking time between the notes and letting things play out?
You take time to make specific statements, and you give people the opportunity to really take those moments in, those musical bits. You get the time to really digest it. Mm-hmm. Somebody like Dizzy may play, you know, a lot of notes. Mm-hmm. And that is the way he was speaking. Some mm-hmm. people talk very fast. Some people talk very, very slow. So you get it. And they're very direct.
So
you get some people say certain things, and you know what? That bit of knowledge is everything I need.
Yeah.
You know?
So some people keep it simple, and because that's who they are and that's how they think and all of that. And what are the physical demands in playing a trumpet? Because it looks hard. It looks harder than strumming a guitar. Well, you know that you got to be brilliant doing that. But like, what did you
trumpet
have?
Trumpet is a very trumpet is a very physical piece of equipment.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to approach it like, you know, a track star. You got to approach it like a bodybuilder. You have to work that muscle out, you know, daily, in and out.
Mm-hmm. You mean your abdomen and your diaphragm and all that stuff?
Well, that too. I was just talking about the lips. Now you just added something else that's making even more hard.
Yeah.
So,
I got big lips. I don't know. Maybe I'd be a good trumpet player, but I've always had big lips. People always, now people say, do you get collagen in your lips? Like when I was little, I used to get in a lot of fights because kids would pick on me about my lips. And then my body grew into, I'm not making this up. Like my lips were like the size of an adult's and I had like an 8-year-old cue ball head. And I joked that I could whisper in my own ear. And then I grew into my lips, and girls are like, man, you got great lips. Did you get collagen? I'm like, no, what are you, out of your mind? I mean, I used to get in fist fights over these lips, but I didn't know the lips were important. But I see these guys blow. I work on The Late Show, and we're talking about John Lampley, and there's I see you guys, and I'm like, how do you not like get a headache? Like, I don't know. I mean, I know this sounds basic, but
I used to get headaches, man.
Oh, yeah.
I used to. And that's a breathing thing, though.
That's what I was going to say, right? Yeah.
When you start to breathe correctly and learn the way your air is supposed to work,
right?
You know, the trumpet becomes a mechanism versus a hindrance.
Mm-hmm.
And you can just play as long as you want to play. And you can, you know, the air is the thing that's propelling. It's the fuel.
Was it scary for you? Because you clearly are there now with this album. And we're talking about your new album, The Musician, which just came out. And was it scary for you? I'm going to make a presumption here as an artist that you go from kind of, like you said, like me with the comedians, you kind of sort of are mimicking or, you know, kind of shadowing people that you admire and then saying, okay, well, I got to have my own sound and my own voice and my own point of view and put yourself out there. Was that scary for you? Was it freeing when you first started to do that in earnest and really, really go for it?
It's a part of the progression.
Yeah.
So it definitely had its moments of, you know, anxiety.
Mm.
And it still does. And it's a process that you have to just get over, and you have to really start to trust yourself and trust that the decisions that you're making are your decisions.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, obviously there's a lot of, you know, a lot of voices from all over the place that tell you that, you know, maybe you should do it this way, maybe you should do it that way. But the minute you get to the point where you say, you know what, I'm just going to jump out, I'm going to swim in the deep end, and I'm going to make it happen, that's when things start to really happen. And I've finally come to that point to trust in myself. You know, I've had the ability to work with, you know, many, many great artists, not just average artists, great artists. And, you know, since I was, you know, pretty good at what I did, people would always call me for that. But at what point do I say, you know what, I appreciate you guys, so I'm going to make my statement now?
Yeah.
You know, that took a while.
Right.
It took a while. So, and I'm finally there, and I'm happy about that.
Well, it's very sophisticated too, because then you say, you know, that the sound starts with the trumpet as the focal point on the album, but it's a collaborative mesh. I'm quoting you. It's a collaborative mesh of genre melded together to make a thoughtful original statement musically. And it's, you seem, and others, in hearing it, you seem to really have tried to kind of keep the listener off balance a little bit, which I think is good, right? So that it doesn't feel one note in the bigger sense of like, okay, this is a pure jazz album. There seems to be, mm-hmm. there's some funk, there's this. That was obviously very intentional. How hard was that to sort of meld those genres together?
You know what? I'm a jazz musician by heart. You know, I'll always be a jazz musician, but my progression wasn't just jazz. When I first moved to New York, you know, I was playing with, you know, a hip hop artist.
Yeah.
And, you know, that in itself opened me up to a wide variety of different kinds of music that I started to come to the point, instead of being a jazz cop, I turned to to the idea of being a music cop. I like good music a lot, and I don't like stuff that I don't like. Mm. So, you know, I purposefully, you know, skewed the line between what jazz is versus what good music is. Mm-hmm. So I love R&B. I love hip hop. I love classical music. I love jazz. I love, you know, all kinds of genres. So yeah. I don't want to just limit myself to that. And mm-hmm. the idea of what social music is, the idea of what, I guess, Black American music is, I guess what music is to me, it's the statements. It's not necessarily what the press calls it. Yeah. The idea of that is so limiting, because there's so many beautiful things, so many beautiful expressions of music that happen right now that yeah. I don't want to label it. Yeah. I mean, the idea of improvisation is the catalyst that holds this entire record together. Mm. To me, what I was trying to do was create a playlist of different music that all goes into one thing. I am the fiber that holds the whole thing together, from the idea of production, from the idea of me playing a trumpet, from the idea of me singing, and from the idea of me visualizing, I want that person, I want that person, this person, I need that sound, I need that instrument. That all is one piece.
Right.
So that is the reason why this whole thing has continuity. Mm. At first, you know, it was tough for me to imagine them all going together, but you know, at some point I had to realize that the catalyst was myself, orchestrating all these, you know, personalities and thoughts together to make one thing.
You have Guy Torrey. Sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead. Go for it.
No, I was just saying Gary Clark Jr., Guy Torrey, a couple people on the album. So now, chicken or the egg here, you're writing and you're like, I want to get Guy Torrey on this. I'm going to write this part for Guy Torrey, or I'm going to write this part and then, Guy Torrey would be good for this. And if you can't get Guy, do you get someone else, or do you change the part? Like, how does that work for you?
You know what? Fortunately, on this album, I was blessed to get all the people that I wanted specifically for each tune.
Wow.
It wasn't the kind of thing to where I call in a session person to come and record this. Each person was picked, handpicked, and, you know, very specific for each song.
Yeah.
The idea of Guy Torrey. Guy Torrey's from St. Louis. Guy Torrey and I go back to, he was opening up for Maxwell. I met him there, and we've been, you know, we've kept up and been friends since then.
Mm-hmm.
So I hit him up because I've always wanted to collaborate with music with him. He's from Ferguson. Well, he's from St. Louis, but he understands what Ferguson is. So on the song "When Will It Stop," which was is about Ferguson, which is about what Black Lives Matter, which is about that, you know, mm-hmm. everybody's lives matter.
Yeah.
I felt that he'd be the perfect person, and since he's a comedian, you know, the idea of him, you know, relaying very sensitive, serious information, it was perfect.
Yeah.
So he was definitely down, and that worked for me. Gary Clark Jr., another person, amazing, you know, artist. I collaborated with a fantastic songwriter, Andrea Pizzicone, on this song. It just worked that Gary was the person to be the orator on this. Mm. So I didn't think of anybody else.
That's great. That's great. Well, listen, you've been blessed, man. It's a great album, and you should be really proud of it. And, you've really done some like soulful and thoughtful and important stuff with it. So I hope everybody goes out and picks it up and listens to it. And, can't thank you enough for being on the show, and it's really
such a pleasure. Thank you, man.
Yeah, thanks for the music lesson. I know I asked some geeky technical questions, but I just am I'm just amazed at how you guys, whatever the instrument, can turn that stuff into something. I'm just using my mouth and acting like an idiot, but you guys are, you know. But if comedy's done right, you can say some stuff with it too. You know, it's got a strong history. But like, I just think that. In listening to this and in reading about how you approached it, it's like, this is a lot of hard work. And I'm glad you didn't get bummed out after you got all your stuff stolen and you know, never kept up your music. Otherwise, we wouldn't have this album. So Kenyon Harrell, the album's true. The Musician. Go get it. If you don't, you're not an American. thanks for being on, man.
Hey, thank you, man. Thanks for having me.
All right, that was Keon Harrell. Very cool. I was from a big family. I don't think I could handle that. I think I'd be getting in fights every day with that many people around me. I get very annoyed when people get that close to me. I'm not good with that. Anyway, I thought he was really, really interesting. His CD is amazing. Check it out. And please go to iTunes and leave us a nice comment if you haven't done so already. And please tell your friends about the podcast. We want to keep spreading the word and adding listeners to it. And we'll have a new one posted for you this Monday. All right. Thanks.